This is Jan Swift, and you're listening to Discover Lafayette, a podcast dedicated to the people and rich culture of Lafayette, the gateway to South Louisiana. We usually tape in the offices of Raider, but today we're taping at my home. But I do want to thank Raider, a hands-on IT service provider that integrates all of your needs for advanced technical support, effective communication options, and cybersecurity. Raider's motto is, you just want it to work, we understand. Please visit RaiderSolutions.com for more information. I'd like to thank Iberia Bank, our premier sponsor. They support our community in so many ways, and their dynamic team is committed to serving the banking needs of clients in this region and throughout the southeastern United States. Iberia Bank offers the resources of a national bank with the personal touch of a community bank. Please visit IberiaBank.com for more information. The generosity of Lafayette General Health also makes this podcast possible. Lafayette General has been a leader in telemedicine. With the Health Anywhere app, your family can access quality urgent care at any time without an appointment, all from the comfort of your home. It's the waiting room redefined. Download the app today at lghealthanywhere.com. Dr. Tina Stefanski, Medical Director of the Regional Office of Public Health, is our guest. Dr. Stefanski oversees the seven-parish region of Acadiana for the Department of Health in all matters relating to maintaining and protecting the health of our citizens. Dr. Stefanski graduated from the LSU School of Medicine and completed her pediatric residency program at LSU School of Medicine's Medical Clinic and Children's Hospital in New Orleans before joining DHH. Dr. Stefanski, welcome to Discover Lafayette.
Hi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Oh, you too. We were talking before we started taping. I think most of us know your name. Typically, we'll hear about you when there's hurricanes or public health emergencies, such as what we're going through now. Would you, before we start talking about the COVID issue, would you talk about what you do on a day-to-day basis on our behalf?
Yeah, sure. So Rod, I've been working with Office of Public Health here in Acadiana for the last 19 years. And, prior to this COVID pandemic that we're, of course, now dealing with, and that's taking the great majority of the time in all of us in public health. We work through our parish health unit. So we have health units in every parish in the region of Acadiana and statewide in most parishes. So we have childhood immunizations, women's health, nutritional programs for kids. We've got some particular interest here in mental health services for children through our health unit here in Lafayette. So it's a pretty broad range of things that we do as far as direct or preventive health services. And then also I work with our epidemiologists. So all diseases that are required to be reported to physicians.
Wow.
For example, things from E. coli to Shigella, certain types of meningitis, all of those are reported to our office.
Mm-hmm.
And so I work very closely with the wonderful epidemiologist, and we follow up on those reportable diseases and try to do what we can to prevent further spread.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got that personal health arm of what we do. We've got the preventive health or epidemiological section, and then we also have an environmental section. So I work with our sanitarians who inspect restaurants here in this region and across the state. To make sure that food preparation is done following the state sanitary code and safely, and also drinking water systems, drinking water in the state of Louisiana, is tested and reported through our office to ensure that our drinking water supply is safe and that we're following EPA guidelines. So it's a little bit of everything: environmental health, preventive personal health, and also prevention of disease through our epidemiology section.
And I know our region of the state probably has its fair share of health issues.
Yes, but we've got a very active and vocal community, and so we've built great relationships over the years. And so we definitely have our fair share of things, but we also really do get things reported to us. We talk about disease prevention, and a very astute and alert medical community who does bring things to our attention. So. I think that kind of set us up for, of course, the situation that we're in now and other disasters that we respond to, and that we've got a very coordinated medical community here in Acadiana.
Did you join the department right after your residency? Was this your first and last job?
Yes, exactly. I did a pediatric residency. I completed a pediatric residency in New Orleans, and I loved, you know, we did some community clinics, public health clinics there in New Orleans, and I loved it. And the timing was just perfect that this position was available. I was going to go into private. I'm a pediatrician by training, and that was, I was ready to go into private practice, you know, with a great group here in town, and then had, you know, this job was available. And so, right, this has been my first job, and it's been a very interesting one.
Mm-hmm. You've been so lucky to find that,
yeah.
You know, to find something that fulfills you. Well, let me ask, you know, here we are, July 2nd, and it seems like since the middle of March, we focus on one thing to the next. We just seem to, I guess we're all trying to make sense of our own behavior, others' behavior. What is the real threat going on? And right now, as we're speaking, we're seeing this dramatic surge of younger people, you know, becoming infected with the coronavirus. And it's just been a dramatic surge. And it's frightening. And I have to say, it's a personal thing. I never knew anyone until this week that actually had the virus and died from it. And Tina, something about it, when you know somebody, it makes it so real, but it should have been real the whole time. And we have been doing what we were supposed to do here in the Swift family, and our friends are the same, but this just is really getting to be frightening about what's happening.
Yeah, it is. And you know, and I'm so sorry about your friend. And you know, you can imagine that magnitude by, you know, the numbers of people that we're seeing who are affected. And you know, what's a little even more concerning to me than usual when we're talking about something like this is that no one really knows what to predict. I really don't know that anyone thought we would be. Pretty sure I'm safe in saying that anyone thought we would be in the position that we're in right now with the numbers of cases that we're seeing and really the increase, you know, so dramatically over just a period of a couple of weeks, and then now that's translating to an increase in hospitalizations. And so I definitely think this is something that it's very concerning because we don't know where we're going to be in a couple of months. There's really no way to predict it. It's new. This is a new virus. It's affecting the whole world. There's, you know, differences in how different areas of the world are impacted. But this is something new. You know, we haven't faced a pandemic to this magnitude, nearly to this magnitude, since 1918. So we're all learning together, and it is frightening because we don't know. And not to alarm anyone, but just I think people need to step back and be very reasonable in what they do within their families, and understanding that this is new. We don't know what the future holds, and so we've got to really listen to the best experts and do whatever we can to try to slow down the spread, so that we do have more information about how to prevent and treat this virus as time goes, because it is very concerning, the rate of growth.
I understand that we still are in pretty decent shape about the number of beds in the hospitals and in the ICU. I just listened to the touching interview that both chief medical officers from Lourdes and Lafayette General did that was released yesterday, just imploring people to take care, to wear masks, to be careful. And I thought that was pretty profound that two competitors such as that, you know, I know they all work together with you, but that was quite a compelling video to watch them, if you have any comments on that.
Yes, no, I mean, it was wonderful. And I think for people to, you know, you definitely saw the sincerity there. You know, this is something that that most of us in the medical community are very concerned about. Certainly those that treat patients directly in the hospitals are seeing the repercussions, just like you with your friend, of really bad outcomes. And that's what we're all trying to prevent. But Jess, it was, you know, I thought a phenomenal interview, and so glad that the people in the community see the people that yes, I've had the opportunity to work with over the last, several months. Because, again, really, the medical community has pulled together, and we've got, you know, we meet regularly. We have a physician's leadership council. We've got individuals that talk from throughout the region, so representing hospitals from throughout this region, you know, speak. There's a call this afternoon. Dr. Blaylock and Reese have pulled this group together. And so there definitely is a medical community pulling, as you would expect, is wanting to pull together, not only in the best treatment for patients, but as you saw from that interview, to try to help reach people. Because it's very hard, it feels like, for me, that the message isn't, it's not sticking. We're hearing just about every credible medical expert around the country saying this with the same message. Mm-hmm. And yet, like I told someone today, people are partying like it's 1999. It's frightening that the message, I don't know how we reach people. So I was so glad to see them maybe, yet another approach at getting people to listen. UL is working to help us with messaging to get to reach young people, because it's not just young people. It's all ages. And I do feel this message that I hear back, that I get a lot is, it doesn't feel real. People don't believe that this virus is real. It hasn't touched anyone in their families. If they haven't, they haven't slowed down, they've continued to do as they normally would, and nobody in their family got sick. So, those kinds of stories, and, so the response, my response is, and you're lucky. Because that's not the experience of many people in this community, yeah. And we need to do better.
I went to a large, I don't want to say the name of the store, but a large, store yesterday. I was getting my car fixed, and I was out in South Lafayette, and I went into the store, and almost no one had on the mask, and it was really surprising. It seems like mm-hmm. in the last week or two, people have really masked up,
right,
the majority
right.
are doing that. And I looked at that, and I ended up speaking with one of the employees, and she said, it's very disheartening for her, an older African-American woman, but she said, unless the governor mandates it, or it's mandated, the stores are not going to be policing. They recommend it, but it just,
right.
it was really shocking to me. So if we can confirm too, from what I heard on that video I was referencing with the two chief medical officers, mm-hmm. the majority of people in the hospital now are still, they're 55 and up, mainly 65 and up in the ICUs. But it's the younger people that we're seeing the resurgence of, the numbers are rising in that group. Is that
right.
is that what you're seeing?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, by far the biggest increase, and it's way outpaces any other age group, is the 18 to 29 mm-hmm. year old, mm-hmm. and in particular 18 to 21. And of course, those individuals generally, although you do have some people who have a more severe case, but generally younger people have are either asymptomatic, mildly symptomatic, maybe something like the flu, but aren't typically the age group that ends up with serious symptoms or hospitalized. And it's certainly typically older individuals. The concern is that as we see this growing number of young people infected, it's going to be, I think of a wave. It's going to continue to build, and sooner or later, it's going to spill over. To a much greater degree than we're seeing now, is the concern mm-hmm. to the older population. And that age group in our region, 70 plus, you actually have seen a leveling or even maybe a small decrease in the number of cases, or we have up until this point.
Right.
And I think that age group is being cautious, but those people also need to be able to go, get out and about and do what they need to do. And so in stores, please wear, masks to protect those people, but also to help us slow down the spread, because as you said, you have people that work in stores. We don't know what their underlying health conditions are. You might inadvertently expose them. Or you might expose someone who then goes home and develops the virus. Maybe an asymptomatic person, so they never know they have it, and then spread to someone who's at high risk. And so there's so much, we've learned so much about the role of the asymptomatic spread of this virus, that's why the message changed. And that's the other, some of the justification for people who just, for whatever reason, don't feel like they need to wear a mask. Part of what again we hear is that there's mixed messages. Well, there's no mixed message. Mm-hmm. Early on, we did not know the role of asymptomatic spread. And so, for example, SARS was a coronavirus. SARS was spread by people who had symptoms. So the initial thought was it's going to be like all these other coronaviruses that were spread by people who are symptomatic. Well, we learned that's not the case. To a great degree, and so that's why we wear masks, to prevent from us from spreading the infection to other people if we're harboring the virus and not knowing.
Okay. Tina, I've got a series of questions. Before I get into that, I'd like to pause for something I do. It's Discover Lafayette's Past. And I'd like to just share this moment before we continue. This is sponsored by our friends at Raleigh Marketing, a full-service digital marketing agency that can assist you with marketing automation, content development, search engine optimization, and strategies on how to use social media to turn into a moneymaker for your business. For more information, please visit RaleighMarketing.com. And now the moment. The great flood of the Atchafalaya and Mississippi Rivers in 1927 was the first major flood experienced by the city of Lafayette. Heavy rains with snow melting resulted in an overflow into the already full Mississippi River and its tributaries. In May 1927, the levee at Bayou de Glaze broke, followed by the levees in Henderson and then Melville. Lafayette became a major refugee center for several weeks, with much of the city covered with surplus tents from World War I. And it housed people in need of shelter. The largest tent city was set up on the Lafayette Fairgrounds, which is now the municipal golf course. Others were also set up at the Holy Rosary Institute in Ile Kapaal, the former home of Governor Alexander Mouton. Lafayette was very fortunate, as only a few acres near Lake Martin were overtaken by water, and the city was spared. And I thought that would be kind of a nice look back, because I think you would have been right in the middle of that.
Yes.
Back in 1927.
Well, gosh.
I know. I
have not heard that story.
Yeah, I'm trying to share past,
gosh,
you know, like bring
yes.
in some past moments so we can learn history and also get to know people like you. So
well, thank you. And you know, people went through their hardship, unfortunately, and we get through things.
Mm-hmm. Always.
Yes.
Right. Well, I had a couple of questions, you know, and I'm just going to start out with this. So I have a 21-year-old. She's my younger daughter, a senior at LSU. And Tina, it's so hard to answer what to do. And I'm just going to ask, like, if this was going on today, I would call you on the phone and say, my daughter was invited to a birthday party, and it's going to be about 9 or 10 people, and it starts in an hour. And somebody just called the host and said they're coming, but they were around somebody that they worked with that they think had COVID. Now, what do you tell your daughter or the host? Like, what is your
right.
advice on that?
So what we tell people first, you know, it's 9 or 10 people. And I can tell you this scenario is what we hear all of the time, a small group like this. And so, you know, we talk a lot about big congregate settings and, you know, bars and big events where you have a couple hundred people crammed together.
Right.
So, but what we hear a lot about is a group just like what you're talking about, people who don't live in the same household mm-hmm. or aren't the small network that see each other every day, or, you know, this is 9 or 10 different people who are all coming from different settings, and you don't know what their exposure has been.
Right.
And they get together and they go out to eat. I mean, we just hear this story all of the time. They have a baby shower. It's, you know, kind of pick a social setting, even with a small group of people, a party at a house. And a couple days later, they find out that someone at that party becomes sick, is tested, they're positive, and then go back and have to call and say, hey, look, you know, this is a problem. So I would probably, now, this is not a very popular decision, but I would tell your 21-year-old daughter, look, it's just not a good idea to do this unless you know where the party going to be. Is it going to be outside? Are y'all spacing apart? Or are you going to sit together in a restaurant around a small table and sit there for 2 or 3 hours and eat or drink, where it may be difficult for you to wear a mask?
Mm-hmm.
You know, to think about those kinds of scenarios. I think if it's outside and people are spaced apart, 6 feet, you know, the key is distance. If you can stay 6 feet between you and other people, wear a face mask when you can, which is hard when you're eating and drinking. So that's why the idea is outside is better than inside,
mm-hmm.
and keeping space. And then the host, that one person definitely shouldn't come. And you also need to assess the level of risk. So for that host who says that somebody at their office or sorry, but anyway, the person who said that someone at their office had tested positive, you know, what you want to know is how closely do they work with them.
Okay.
So if it's, you know, if it's a big office building, if it's the Capitol and it's one person, you know, then you're not mixing, right? But if it's a small office and there's lots of interactions, close interactions throughout the day, then that person's at high risk and really should be quarantined and stay home for 14 days. And what we use as a close contact to guide us is within 6 feet for 15 minutes or more.
So oh, okay.
You sit and have lunch with, or you share an office with, a very close office, or y'all sit together frequently and discuss things and not wearing masks and are close together, then that's a level of risk that you should then be, you go home and you stay home for 14 days to make sure you're not going to eventually develop symptoms. But even removing that person who says that they were exposed at home, it's just because the level of concern that I have, because we're seeing so much spread among these young adults who are getting together, even in small groups, but they're small groups of people who don't normally see each other.
Right.
So again, pulling, you know, everyone coming from their own day-to-day life and then or getting together and then something, you know, you find out a couple of days later somebody was positive.
Yeah, whether it's
for work,
their
family. It's a very common scenario.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right. But some people, I think, are going way far the other way. They'll say, oh, my neighbor found out they had it, I'm going to quarantine. And if you're not really close with your neighbor.
And I think I heard a word today. Someone was speaking on the national news, the story in moderation. I mean, you just definitely have to, you know, think through things. It's a respiratory virus. So just think about it like that. It's 6 feet, you know, so it's close contact face to face is the highest level of risk. But you can see how a group of 9 or 10 kids that are getting together and there's going to be that close contact and there will be transmission if somebody in that group is carrying the virus. And
right.
So that's where we're seeing the risk at this point.
So if you're going to the beach, let's say, you know, you're trying to go to Florida, I hope they still allow people to come in. You know, we waited until they lifted the ban and made plans for later this month. And so if you're outside and you're with your family, the breeze is blowing and you're not close to others, what's your advice on that? You know, traveling.
So I would say, again, I think that's definitely a less risk. So a less opportunity. It's a less risky situation, I guess the right way to say it. So if you're, again, you're on a beach, and hopefully the beaches or will be monitoring and ensuring that there's safe space for people. So that, like you said, you and your family can have your own little area where you're not shoulder to shoulder with someone else.
Right.
And then I think that's fine. Again, it's your family that you know, not bringing two families together, but your family that's been together, you know, that has been together and associating with each other over the last several weeks. So it's, you know, your small little network. Mm-hmm. And then I think it's fine. You know, I would be careful around, when you're trying to get on the elevator, you know, wear a face mask when you're transitioning. They call them transitions, right? So when you're walking around and you do think you're going to be in a position where you might be in a crowd.
Right.
Of course, try to avoid it. And again, things like elevators, and I'll try to avoid being too crowded in a crowded situation. But once you get to the beach, you know, I think that's fine as long as you can have that space between other groups of people.
Are y'all still seeing a disproportionate number of deaths from the minority community?
So, yes, that's really an issue, kind of a nationwide issue, seeing an increase in morbidity and minority, and of course, older individuals. But yes, it's a disproportionate share in Black individuals. And often we know that those individuals are have higher rates of lots of these underlying health conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And so we talk about people who do worse when they are infected or exposed and become infected with this virus, and that's people who, in addition to being older than 65, who have high blood pressure, diabetes, kidney disease, and unfortunately, those are all chronic diseases where we see much higher rates in Louisiana in Black individuals. And so, you know, it's very unfortunate. And again, while we really want to protect everyone in our community by wearing these face masks, because you don't know who it is that you're encountering that has one of these underlying health problems.
Right. And my friend that passed away did have a lung issue. You know, he had an underlying health issue, and it just made it tough, I think, to fight it once.
Right.
Once
yes,
it hit.
It's you know, when you read the journal articles, and I can, you know, assuredly, Dr. Logan Kaufman could speak about it very well. That it's this is a different virus. It's got a different disease process. You know, there's some individuals who have significant lung injury. And we're now hearing about people who recover and have very significant damage mm-hmm. to their lungs.
Right.
And so it is. It's just I can't say it enough that it's a new virus. It's definitely a different disease process, and the treatment. We're all still trying to learn what's the most effective way to treat this virus, especially those people who end up mm-hmm. in the ICU and really struggling.
Does the medical community have any idea if this will be something similar to chickenpox, where it could turn into shingles later in life? Is there any idea about long-term, even if you don't suffer damage, let's say, to your lungs from being on a ventilator or something, but is there any thought about this recurring in other ways as life goes on, if my question makes sense?
Yeah, sure. No, and the answer is we don't know. We still don't know if, for example, someone gets this virus and recovers, how long, if they have any protection from getting it again, so if they're protected, and if they are, then how long does that protection last? So mm-hmm. when you think of chickenpox, for example, later on you may develop shingles, mm-hmm. but you're not likely, or it's very unlikely that you would develop chickenpox.
Right.
But once you get chickenpox, you have really should have lifelong immunity from getting mm-hmm. it again. Mm-hmm. But we don't know with this virus yet if you get it, you get it and recover, are you protected? And if you are, how long does that protection last? That's still being studied. So we don't even know if you're going to be protected, let alone what might happen. Again, it's so new, we have no way of knowing yet what might the future might hold for people who did have it and recovered. Is there going to be some other complicating factor that we can't predict yet?
Right.
We just don't know.
If people have been exposed, I've heard about the contact tracing. How does that work? Who calls you?
Sure. So if someone is exposed, the way it works is if you test positive, the reports all come to the Louisiana Department of Health. So if someone's tested, and I do want to clarify this because there's lots of questions about how we report tests. And lots of things I've seen on social media that just aren't right, that are totally incorrect. And so one of them is, so if you're tested in the state of Louisiana, the test results are reported to us. Mm-hmm. And when we report those results out, there's a continual process to remove duplicated. So if, for example, I'm tested and I test positive and then I get tested again in 2 weeks to see if I turn negative, and I'm still testing positive and I do that every 2 weeks and I still test positive, I'm only counted once. Those duplicated results are continually being removed. We have a process for that. So when you see the case counts reported, that's individual case count. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while, we'll have to go in and remove duplications that might have made its way through. So those are individual case counts. And then we also only report the viral or the more right now accurate test diagnosis. So all those tests are reported to us by the lab. It's an electronic reporting. And then you get a call from someone who's contracted with the Louisiana Department of Health, who's contact tracers. And then they'll call you. They'll make sure you knew that you had tested positive, which hopefully you'd already heard from your provider. And then they just go through and try to figure out, number one, where you might have been exposed, so that they can bring that to our attention to say, hey, we're seeing a lot of exposures at, this place. And then, so Tigerland, right, for example, mm-hmm. that we all know about that. So, those things come out of our contact tracing, where you start to talk to multiple individuals, and it's a secure database, of course. It's only reported to us. And so we see that, and if it gets to a point where there's an area of concern, we will call. We'll call a business, whatever it is, if it's a church, whatever that common place might be, we'll call it and talk about the fact that there's been some transmission, and let's think of what we can do to prevent further transmission. So we try to figure out where you might have been exposed, and then we work with you to figure out who you might have exposed. Mm-hmm. And so you give us a list of names and say, hey, I had dinner 2 days before my symptoms started with this group of people. We then call those people. We don't give any names. We just say on this date, on June 30th, you were exposed to somebody with COVID. Do you have any symptoms? And this is what you should look for. If you develop these symptoms, this is what you should do. That's all that process is. It's just getting a list of individuals, trying to figure out where you might have been exposed, and then helping us to figure out who we then need to notify so that they don't mm-hmm. then perhaps you can see right where the cycle could continue. We're trying to break that cycle.
You know, with all the spam calls people get, I was reading online about this, and I think they say if you get a call, it'll show Department of Health, or it'll show the department, so you can ask to verify to make sure that you're not being scammed. But I mean, they're not asking for your bank account or your social security number.
Exactly. They're just gone through. They're just gone, you know, kind of through your activity over the last, you know, just couple of weeks before you tested positive, and then right immediately that 2 days prior to your symptoms starting, or if you decide to test and those symptoms, we go back 2 days. And so, if I develop symptoms today, I would start 2 days. I would trace my last 2 days back to the KD. So the people I need to notify if I was in close contact with them.
Right.
I need to notify these people that they need to be on the lookout for symptoms. And you know, I think it's also really important. First of all, people need to cooperate with us. This is the only way we're gonna. This is our only hope of trying to against it to kind of stop that cycle. Mm-hmm. But it also helps us to give good information to people. So you know, for example, if I was sick and 2 days prior I had exposed someone who cared for, you know, an infant who had a young child at home or who helped to care for an elderly parent, you know, we need that person to know what's happening so that they can, again, be on the lookout for symptoms themselves in order to protect those that they're around.
Right.
They themselves don't have health problems. And so these contact tracers can give you that kind of good information. They can take the burden off of you so you're not having to go back and call these people, which could be embarrassing for some people, although it shouldn't be. So we take that burden off of you and we make those notifications, never, of course, naming you.
I see. So I think I also read online, or maybe the chief medical officers from the hospital said this, but are they still only testing people that have symptoms? Mm-hmm. Who can get a COVID-19 test?
So ideally, anyone who's interested could be tested. Anyone who was exposed but asymptomatic could be tested. But the reality is that it is becoming increasingly problematic, the whole testing landscape. And so it can take up to 10 to 12 days in some cases for us to get results back for people who are tested. And so what we're trying to do is, and so this is going to be a shift, because over the last several weeks, we've been testing anyone, for the most part, many places are testing anyone who's interested in being tested. We're trying to, now based on supply, it may even change from day to day at some clinics. So you really have to call around, and it's not the best, it's not the best guide, but that's really what we've got. So if you're symptomatic, then you should be able to find a test. If you're symptomatic, especially if you were exposed, but if you have symptoms that could be consistent with this virus, knowing how prevalent it is in the community, you should be able to be tested, regardless of if you have any underlying health problems. However, if you're asymptomatic, you may have trouble finding a test right now. And really, the guidance doesn't change. So if you're asymptomatic, but you were exposed, a close contact to someone with this virus, then you really just need to stay home, quarantine yourself for 14 days, and if you develop symptoms, then you should be tested. So if you're tested, it doesn't change anything. Part of the reason we're in a bind is that there's a misunderstanding that if someone is exposed to this virus and they get a negative test, that they're fine, they can continue. But no, if you're exposed, you have to stay home until 14 days have passed from your last contact, because some people may develop symptoms in 2 to 5 days. Some people may develop as long as 13, 14 days. So regardless, you just need to stay home for 14 days. And a test is only a picture of where you are today. If you're incubating the virus and you test it again in 2 days, you might then turn positive. Mm-hmm. We don't have enough tests to test people every day.
Yeah. Thank you for explaining that. I was going to ask some of those particular questions about the 2 to 5 days. And along those lines,
most people, if they're exposed, will develop symptoms in 2 to 5 days. But we do see that there are people who may take as long as 14 days to develop. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I read online, and I think this was from some information you had shared, that the virus is not viable or able to be transmitted past 9 days. Would you explain that?
Sure. So, earlier on, again, we're still learning. But at this point, the best evidence that we have is that although some people may continue to shed the virus, Some people may, if you continue, as they, you continue to test them, and so a nasal swab can pick up viral RNA. So it's a very sensitive test. And so some people may continue to test positive for 4, 5, 6 weeks after their initial infection. And so initially we were saying people should have 2 negative test results to return to work. Well, now what we've learned, not only do we have a testing shortage, that's not a good practice. We also know that people may shed this, may still show positive, but those viral particles are essentially not transmittable. It's not live virus. So CDC has not been able to culture live virus past 9 days.
Okay.
So that's where we get the 10 days. If you're sick, you stay home for 10 days, and then you should be able to go back to work or back to your regular activities. Because even if you were still testing positive on a test, that virus should not be viable. It's not likely to be infected. You're not likely to be contagious.
So the time period, when does that start, though, Tina?
So that's what we use. So, you know, we have 10 days, 14 days. So the 14 days is how long you stay home if you're exposed, because it may take up to 14 days to develop symptoms. If you are sick, you do develop symptoms. So the day you start, so if my symptoms start today, tomorrow I will start counting day 1.
Okay.
And then you count 10 days. And once you get through 10 days, you're not likely to be infectious. We no longer recommend a test to prove that, because again, so many people are continuing to test positive, even though the virus is not viable.
Unless they're going to work like in a nursing home or something, then I read that you do say that
14 days in a nursing home, they would say 14 days just to give a couple of more days, because they're going to work in these congregate settings. So someone who's going to work in a nursing home or a shelter, we would say, you know, then you need a prison. Stay home for, you know, you really give it a couple of extra days, and then they can go back to work.
What are you seeing in the homeless population?
So we have a great homeless coalition in Lafayette. We really, really, really do. And they have been working hard from the beginning for prevention. And so, thankfully, you know, that has paid off, and it's, you know, we have not nearly seen the issues that they've seen in other places in shelters. Because that's really the concerning environment, is any congregate where people live together in close quarters. That's where the risk is. So we've got, as I know, a great homeless coalition that has been working really, really hard for months to try to continue to prevent spread of infection.
I think it's been amazing, that and the jail population. I know that they recently had someone, but out of all the places, it seems like the homeless shelters and the jail would be places you would see a lot of cases, and we just haven't seen that.
No, again, very fortunate. And unfortunately, we have seen it in our nursing homes as nationwide. That's been, because that's a population that's so vulnerable. And I will say our nursing homes have been working incredibly hard to try to prevent further spread. And they've been doing a tremendous job. Mm-hmm. That picture has drastically changed. And so now we see that, of course, some of that is likely from some immunity. But also, the nursing homes are really doing a tremendous job with regular weekly now testing of patients and staff. They can quickly identify people who are positive, and then kind of cohorting people so that they can try to reduce further spread in nursing homes. So that's been really impressive.
Have I asked you the questions you expected? Was there something that you thought I might ask that I haven't brought up?
No, I think masks, I think if they're, you know, lots of people challenge the effectiveness of masks. And so every once in a while, someone will send me a LinkedIn article, which I really appreciate, because it helps me to understand where the confusion is.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of misunderstanding or articles that are cited, very good articles, but it has nothing to do with what we're talking about. So where you'll see an article cited that where masks in the hospital setting, face coverings don't protect the healthcare worker if they're exposed to infectious patients from any kind of respiratory illness. And we already know that. So in hospitals and healthcare settings, they wear surgical masks or a higher level, N95. But when we're talking about wearing a face covering for COVID, we're not talking about protecting the wearer. Mm-hmm. Wearing the mask keeps your droplets essentially to yourself so that you're not spreading your virus into the atmosphere or into the space between you and someone else. Mm-hmm. So it's not a valid comparison at all. But that's often what is cited. And so, in fact, there's other great evidence of the usefulness of face covering. And when, you know, The Lancet had a great article comparing 16 countries where face coverings were used, face masks mm-hmm. were used to prevent, if we were talking about the spread in the wear, and were found to be effective. So that's one thing. I do think that people, when they talk about research, it's not comparing, we're not talking about the same thing. And so people just need to read a little bit more. And the articles are confusing, especially if you're, you know, a layperson. I mean, they're confusing for me when I read some of these articles. But when you start to, when you read them very carefully, you see that they're not talking mm-hmm. about wearing masks to source control or essentially just keeping those droplets from circulating.
I've never tried a cloth mask yet. I don't have one. I've been using the ones you buy, you know, the blue ones at the store.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're so hot. Do you wear a cloth mask most of the time? What do you have?
Yeah, and they are. I have a cousin who made, and I told her I feel very protected when I wear her mask, but I might pass out.
It's thick.
Because it's very thick. But it is. It's hard to get used to.
It is.
At times, and so you need to find something that's comfortable for you, and especially as the heat in the summer, in the summer months, we just kind of need to figure out what it is that we can wear and continue to survive in this heat.
Yeah, I think it's an opportunity for entrepreneurs to develop something,
too.
You know,
that's yes,
a little bit thinner,
too.
But yet works.
Still protective.
You know,
yeah.
Keep that. You know, I had one last question I forgot to ask you, this herd immunity issue. Is that possible, do you think? Is that something that really is possible for this?
I guess we're so far from it. You know, when you realize that the percentage of people that need to develop immunity. And also, I guess the question is still unanswered. If we do develop immunity, how long does it last?
Right.
So when we talk about herd immunity, again, for something like measles or chickenpox, even meningitis, we know that if you develop antibodies, they're protective. We still don't have that evidence for this virus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's everybody's hope, but we still don't know that. So I don't even think we can consider herd immunity until we know that that we get any kind of long-term immunity if we develop this, you know, symptoms from this virus and then recover. So unfortunately, I think a vaccine will be our greatest hope, and hopefully it looks like there's some candidates on the horizon, you know, maybe sooner rather than later.
Yeah, that's great. With modern technology and the great minds that we have, you know, working on this, it's very encouraging, but still, I think day to day, we need to watch out for our brother so we can watch out for ourselves and not
that's
spread
right.
it.
Yeah. Exactly. And that's what I think we do so well here in the support of the state. And I hope that people, they're going to hear a message that reaches them. You know, I don't know which one it'll be, because there's definitely unity in the message. And so I think I'm hoping over the next couple of weeks, more and more people will try to help with messaging to reach the entire community.
Me too.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Tina Stefanski, Chief Medical Director of the Region 4 Office of Public Health, I want to thank you for taking time, and we're taping this by phone. And as I apologized to you before we started taping, I hope the quality, you know, is passable.
Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate your time. And, you know, every time I see you, it seems like you're on TV explaining these things. But I wanted to let you have your voice heard in a relaxed
thank
setting.
You. I appreciate it. And thanks for accommodating me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I'd like to thank those that make this show possible. We've been very lucky to have some generous sponsors: Iberia Bank, Lafayette General Health, Rally Marketing, and of course, Raider, the company that helps us mix this tape. Raider is just great. And Jason Sikora, thank you for making this tape possible. And I'd like to thank our listeners. You can visit our website at discoverlafayette.net to hear Dr. Stefanski and all of our other really interesting. I think we have over 160 guests that have been on so far, and I encourage you to learn more about our community. On behalf of Discover Lafayette, thank you for listening. This is Jan Swift.